Chronicles of Leadership, Chapter 3. In this chapter, John Keane relates his first contact from a member of a secret society. Their secret has been passed on through a succession of books, each from a carefully chosen future author. He also outlines his recruitment to Urmston University, where he meets the celebrated Vice-Chancellor, Wendy Lockinge. Chapter 3. Monty Beamer's Beehive. Maybe it was a dream of becoming a pioneer, a searcher for hidden secrets, that was the primary inducement for me to join the university. The idea had been triggered by a meeting with an old man after a lecture on economic theory. I'd argued rather too vehemently in favour of the unfashionable Keynesian approach. I was very much in the minority. The old man stunned me when he said that I could only have said what I did if I'd found a secret hidden deep in one of Keynes's works. He was right, but I was far from ready to share what I had found with anyone else. "Keep looking," the old man said. "One day we will meet again. But before that, you will find that your future lies outside your present occupation." Looking back, I see how right the old man proved to be, and how my entry ticket was provided by Montague Beamer of Urmston University. After one of his lectures at the Meniscus Training Centre, he invited me to visit him and his group at the university. I thought it was no more than a friendly invitation to see his centre. It turned out to be far more significant than that. We arranged to meet a few weeks later and then go on for lunch at the Globe, a pub on the new ring road around Urmston. The external appearance of Beamer's location came as a surprise to me. It was a dilapidated building the size of a small farmyard barn, tucked away on the fringes of the campus. It was a far cry from the imposing glass and concrete piece of architecture shown on the cover of the brochure he had given me. I found out later that his prospectus showed the entire new science wing of the university. It is one of the few examples of why he had earned the name Beamer the Schemer. He told me that his building had once been the location of an old science laboratory. I could imagine the original polished wood benches, cupboards full of glass tubing and assorted glass-blowing accessories. "These are thought capsules rather than experimental laboratories now," he explained to me. The building had been divided into individual but cramped spaces for around a dozen occupants. The overall effect was a beehive on two levels. I wondered why it was so deserted. "Out on fieldwork," Beamer explained, "except for Dr. Brush, who was around here somewhere." I found it strange that he hadn't arranged for me to come at a time I could have met more of his people. Beamer went off briefly to attend to some urgent business, leaving me with a recent copy of a technical journal to read. He'd scarcely left when a figure came down the corridor struggling with an unstable bundle of books. He kicked open the door of one of the rooms. I helped him decant his burden on the already cluttered floor of his thought capsule. He introduced himself as Jonathan Brush. The shelves around the walls of his cell were overflowing with folders, files, papers, reference books, and annual volumes of scientific journals. He fumbled for a cigarette. Smoking was already banned from most public areas that I'd ever worked in. Brush squinted at me as he lit up. "You the new boy?" I said I was only visiting to see the department and take lunch with Dr. Beamer. "You'll be back," Brush said. "Once he's identified a victim, he weaves his spell. If he's invited you to lunch, you'll be working here next term." Brush was clearly of a rather gloomy temperament. He'd also been drinking. "What's it like working here?" I asked him. "Could be worse. Beamer lets you get on with things. Just working some reference to science and society into your publications. Oh, I see that his name goes on the front with you as his co-author. At least he doesn't expect you to work all the time on one of his nutty Save the World projects." He went on talking as if it was a given that I would be hired by the university. "Another thing you have to watch out for," he went on. "Beamer's made a lot of enemies. The Dean, Professor Snee, department heads on the senior leadership team. Amazing he survived, really. Snee in particular has it in for him. And for all of us pariahs. But the Vice-Chancellor has a soft spot for Beamer and his recruits. People like me are on rolling contracts. You'll have to find your own survival fund sooner or later, but Beamer fights for us, and if you hang around long enough, it's easier for them to keep you on than to dispose of you. Sounds like the arrangements we have in Meniscus, I joked. I thought the man was so negative that even after a brief encounter, I was already discounting his jaundiced remarks. Brush pulled another cigarette out of the packet and scrutinised me carefully. Before he could respond further, we were interrupted by the return of Dr. Beamer. "Lunch," he announced. "You coming with us, Jonathan?" Brunch grunted, which appeared to be a guttural but clearly understood rejection of an offer of a free lunch. As we left, he began moving books around to find a space for his recently acquired volumes. The Globe was a favourite meeting place for university staff and students. Among the notices displayed at the entrance, there was one announcing it is the meeting place for a group of Urmston poets dedicated to the dialect tradition of John Collier. It seemed that John Collier, who lived in the 18th century, wrote his poetry as Tim Bobbins. The John Collier Appreciation Society was organised by Mr. Scrivener from the university. If I get hired, I'll drop by, I thought. Montague Beamer was an enjoyable company for a lunchtime discussion. Just like Brush, he talked as if I was to be joining his little scientific beehive as soon as I could be released from meniscus. I continued to be attracted to the possibility, spurred on by the mysterious encouragement I had received from the old man. During coffee, I mentioned the notice about the Port Society and its university connection. "Scrivener, yes, he's one of the university's senior management team. I don't have much to do with him. He's in humanities. Scientists don't do poetry." I didn't say how much I disagreed with him about scientists not doing poetry. I promised myself I would make a point of contacting Scrivener, maybe at a meeting of his poetry society. I was already thinking that I would one day be leaving Meniscus for Urmston. A few months later, my hiring came about as Brush and maybe the old man had predicted. An arrangement had been proposed by Dr. Beamer and been accepted by Dr. Tiskothic, the head of the Meniscus organisation. Beamer was to receive funds from Meniscus that would support my work until I could generate income to subsidise the arrangement. If that hadn't worked out at the end of my first year, I would return to my old job. Technically, I was on sabbatical leave from Meniscus Industries. Shortly after he had received confirmation of the agreement, Beamer told me I should meet with the Vice-Chancellor, would ratify the arrangements he was putting in place. "Just a formality," Beamer reassured me. "I fixed up an appointment for Thursday at the Vice-Chancellor's palace." Beamer could be vague at times. I was still at the stage of accepting what he told me at face value. By the time I arrived at the Vice-Chancellery, I was having second thoughts. Was it really a formality? Appointments were supposed to be through a formal interview panel set up by the university. I hadn't even been asked to provide a CV. I hesitated at the antechamber to the Vice-Chancellor's suite of offices when I caught sight of someone intently watering a floral table display. She was not quite fashion model slim and not quite fashion model tall. A charcoal business suit with the faintest of pinstripes would have said senior administrator or registrar at the hospital where I'd recently been a long-stay guest. "Flowers," she said, carrying on with the watering can. "More trouble to look after than undergraduates." She turned towards me, pointing the nozzle of the watering device like a miniature pistol. "Looking for the Vice-Chancellor?" I was about to agree. Then a split second before falling into a trap, I recognised her. I was face to face with Wendy Lockinge, University Vice-Chancellor and formerly celebrity detective. Later, I found out she was known to pretend to be a personal assistant for the greater embarrassment of any visitor who was acting in what she considered a patronising fashion. In my case, she quickly decided I had known or worked out her true identity in advance. "Come on through, Dr. Keane," she said. "I'm usually addressed as Wendy by college and friends, except when I'm being acted officially in the role of Vice-Chancellor." "It's Glenda behind my back, a rather outdated reference to a character in Private Eye, I believe." I wondered if I was expected to call her Wendy or Vice-Chancellor. I decided to address her as Professor Lockinge, and she never suggested an alternative. In her presence, I found myself talking far too much about myself. I mentioned my interest in an overlooked aspect in the life of John Maynard Keynes. Although I never talked about it to anyone else, I also mentioned the meeting with an old man who would encourage me in my research ambitions on the secret life of the great economist. Her expression didn't change at that. It was as if I had told her something she'd been waiting to hear. "This old man, did he tell you his name?" I said he hadn't. "Or what he knew about you?" "Not really, only he seemed to know quite a lot." "Including where you worked?" I tried to remember. "I don't think so." She shrugged as if she had lost interest in my rather fanciful tale. "I suppose Dr. Beamer has explained how the system works here. Are there other questions you would like to ask?" "What happens after my contract runs out?" My understanding was I would return to Meniscus with all the problems with Calendar. She explained I was not appointed as part of the charmed inner circle of academics holding tenured positions. "Of course, Dr. Beamer may find additional funding, or there may be future opportunities to transfer to an academic position, in which case you would be considered in open competition for the appointment." And then her parting remarks. I'll never forget them. "I appreciate your choice to change career and join us here. You'll find both freedom and support of your academic goals. But one more thing. Academics are nervous about ideas that seem to have a whiff of the anthropomorphic or paranormal about them. I suggest you remember that as you are looking for the focus of your research." I'd been gently but clearly warned about my classroom enthusiasm of using animals to illustrate points, and also that I would be advised to keep silence about my meeting with the mysterious old man and his predictions for what lay ahead of me. That suited me perfectly.